Hello and welcome to the Lebanese Politics Podcast. My name is Nizar Hassan, joined as usual by Benjamin Red. How are you today, Ben?
I'm doing good. We're at the very end of it. End of the race, Nizar.
Yeah, man, this is the last episode before the elections and things are, you know, quite intense.
Yeah, the rhetoric's heating up. Everything's heating up. I don't know that the excitement necessarily is broadly heating up.
Yeah.
I guess we'll find out on Sunday. We're recording this on Thursday night. So if anything crazy happens, like tomorrow, like, don't blame us. We didn't know. But we did want to get out this one, last episode before the elections, just sort of looking ahead to walk through, you know, exactly what's going to happen, sort of talk about some of the outcomes that potential outcomes that some people are talking about, and, you know, whether that's in the range of possibility or not, and then sort of what comes after that and what the importance of this is. So hopefully this will be a nice quick episode. We've had a bit longer episodes recently, but we're going to try to get quick, straight to the point, and just sort of walk through all of this stuff.
You know, so much is at stake, but we don't want to try to predict the outcomes of the elections, because why? You know, we can just
right.
report on them next week with facts and stuff. But, you know, it's good to have an idea coming into the election, to the main vote on Sunday, what we're expecting after the vote, after the how will the parliament look like, what will be the main conflicts, etc.
Right. So very quickly, just to start out, let's get the basics out of the way. Friday night at midnight, that is when the supposed media blackout and campaigning blackout starts. Usually, you know, this isn't exactly adhered to.
Yeah.
Or at least not as much as it probably should be under the law. But that's when that happens. So basically all day Saturday is supposed to be a blackout. And then Sunday is voting. Polls open 7 a.m. They close at 7 p.m. Nice and easy to remember. However, I mean, keep in mind, though, this is an election. And sometimes, you know, the Interior Ministry needs to, you know, extend voting at some location because there's just like lines of people out the door or something like that. So that could happen. But most polls should be closing at 7 p.m. on Sunday. And then we're not really sure when we're going to know, but if things go like they did in 2018, then we should get sort of some initial results leaked on Sunday night. And that should include, you know, some voter turnout numbers, as well as the hustles, the thresholds for actually entering parliament in various districts. Usually that stuff comes out, and usually political parties or lists will like to claim that they won a certain number of seats based on whatever knowledge they've been able to get from their own electoral machines. Last time we had a general idea of how things were panning out on Sunday evening, but there were still questions, you know, like, oh, well, is this seat going this way or this way in a number of districts? And then last time it was Nuhad Mashnouk, who was the interior minister. He came out, he waited all the way until like Monday evening to actually come out with results. And even then they didn't have complete results. It was mostly complete. I think Akkar was missing. So if things go as they did last time, we should know hopefully the day after. And one other thing to note here, the Interior Ministry does have this new electronic system for, you know, sending things from constituencies into the central Interior Ministry Elections Office. So maybe that will work and make things a little bit faster. I don't know. Or maybe it'll not function and, and things will take even longer. Who knows? But yeah, that's the basic timeline that we are looking at just on the ground, what you can maybe expect. That's if things go as last time.
Okay, so beyond the logistics, the big questions today are related to what will change from these elections. What will the outcome of these elections be? And one of the main things that we've been covering in the last three episodes heading up into this election, two main transformations, political transformations that might be translated into different parliament composition, you know, the political composition of parliament. The first of them is Saad Hariri and the Future Movement's decision to not, you know, wage a campaign this time, to kind of halt all political activity. And this had a huge impact that we talked about. You can go back to the last few episodes. And the main thing we have been talking about is the idea that the main party that used to grab most Sunni seats in Lebanon and many other seats that are not Sunni but in Sunni-dominated areas is the future movement. And now that it's not there, its former figures, more minor figures, are kind of spread across different lists. Some of them going with the Lebanese forces, others going with other alliances. And there isn't one clear future movement that we might expect will be forming a bloc in the parliament after the election. Also, because of this reality, the chances of Hariri-affiliated people to reach parliament are less than before. They don't have the resources, the backing of Hariri and his main allies that provide them with this huge electoral machine that can actually get many thresholds and stuff like that. So the situation this time for what used to be the future movement is quite tricky, and this means seats for grabs.
Absolutely. And the other thing that we were talking about is the battle within the Christian space. It seems as though the FPM is losing a lot of its power. It was the biggest bloc in parliament last time. So you were just talking about the future movement going away. Also, the FPM is not going to look the same. Most people think that it's going to lose seats. Certainly, it's already lost candidates to other lists, you know, people who are actually in the bloc defecting, going somewhere else. What we see here is sort of like the end of the Ahed. There was this agreement, you know, between the Aounis and Hariri, the future movement, that allowed Michel Aoun to come into power, to become president, and for Hariri to come back as prime minister. And that's been sort of like the basis of a lot of politics. And it was, it was reaffirmed and strengthened in 2018 with these two big parties that had made this deal, getting the two biggest blocks, and that's done.
Yeah, it's a huge transformation. The power consolidation that meant there is this Ahed Jadid is now like shattered, right, all over the place, because it was Hariri's proximity to the Shia duo and the Hezbollah's alliance with Aoun and Lebanese forces' support for Aoun to become president. So many, you know, circumstantial things that happened then that allowed this consolidation to happen. Today, we're very far from that situation. The LF and the FPM are, you know, have a more heated battle than ever before. They're really like bumping their heads over Christian representation. So it's not going to be anything similar to what we've been seeing before. And the main change is that, you know, this agreement, this political agreement, the formed government and decided things in the last, you know, more than 4 or 5 years in this country is now not there. And we don't know really what will be the form of the new kind of power consolidation that might happen later.
Right. So one of the things that a lot of people are talking about and asking about is, okay, March 8th, March 14th, what's going on with that? And in particular, like, is March 8th going to, you know, get 2/3 of parliament that would allow them to do all sorts of stuff, amending the constitution, or not? Just to give you a lay of the land, so after the 2018 elections, the blocs looked something like this. If you were to classify the blocs in terms of March 8th versus March 14th, and there's a lot of sort of like gray areas here, but if you were to really just, I guess, make certain assumptions, then the number you might come out with for March 8th was 71 parliamentarians against 53 parliamentarians for March 14th. You know, that wasn't anywhere close to the 2/3 mark for March 8th. 2/3 of parliament is 86 MPs. So in order for March 8th to get a, you know, 2/3 this election, they would have to gain 15 seats overall. And that's a big ask, regardless of what elections you're talking about here in Lebanon. You know, a gain of 15 seats would be absolutely massive, especially when you're considering it on these like sort of grand scales of, you know, March 8th, March 14th. Very, very, I think, difficult to do, but because there is a little bit more uncertainty, because, you know, all of this stuff that's going on, especially, you know, future movement, the bedrock of March 14th, going away, you know, is that actually possible? And I think for this, we have to, I mean, we can't give definite answers, but we can definitely talk about the trends. So yes, we do have the future movement going down. But if we look a little bit closer into it, like if we take Beirut 2, for instance, West Beirut, which is a future movement stronghold, the future movement won 5 seats there last time in 2018. Six seats total on their list. One of those was PSP, but five of those were Future Movement. Now, the worry from some sides is that, okay, because Satori has withdrawn, some Sundanese feel like, oh no, we need to withdraw as well. We need to not even vote. This should be a boycott. And if that happens, then the electoral threshold will fall and it will allow March 8th forces, whether that is candidates associated with the FPM or with Amal or with Hezbollah or Ahbash, one of their smaller allies, maybe they'll be able to pick up quite a few seats. However, on the other hand, you have other Sunnis coming in, you know, very strident March 14th style Sunnis like Fuad Makhzoumi coming in, the list supported by Fuad Sanyora coming in to try and sort of take those votes and hold that ground.
Yeah, and there is this talking point among these two campaigns, Makhzoumi's campaign and Sanyora's campaign. I received a request to have Biso as a kind of permanent guest on the podcast, and I think...
Well, Biso definitely wants to come in. I don't know if you can hear that, but he's he's unhappy being locked outside.
So both campaigns, Sanyora's list and Makhzoumi's list, in their daily like mobilization with Sunni populations in Beirut, they're using now this talking point, which is don't let Hezbollah choose your Sunni MPs, you know. This is a very strong message, and I've heard from a couple of people that it resonated with them in the sense of we're not sectarian, but Hezbollah is sectarian, and they're trying to take over the Sunni votes and the Sunni representation, etc. It's always tricky because the same people might be saying, like 2 minutes earlier, saying like we need to get rid of sectarianism, we need to go through to you know a civil state or a secular state and all of that. When things get to, you know, a specific political choice with a scary enemy, then sometimes you see this sectarian consolidation, like people saying, even if I don't like Makhzoumi, I don't believe in him, if he's the one who's going to prevent Hezbollah from taking a Sunni vote in Beirut, then I'm going to vote for him. Obviously, Makhzoumi is probably going to win regardless if you if you vote for him or not, because we know from the last election he brings in a lot of votes, he has a huge network and aid, etc. But the question of the Sunni vote versus the Sunni representation is here in Beirut. There's also the question of whether the opposition might actually grab one or two of these seats, because there's some people in the opposition who are focusing on this aspect as well, saying, be careful, if you don't vote for us, you will allow March 8th and Hezbollah to take over your representation. So if you're boycotting because Hariri told you so, then think again. So we cannot predict at all, because ultimately this is a political psychology issue, you know, whether people will go vote and for whom, etc. But yeah, generally, I think what we can conclude for sure is that there will be no such thing clearly as the Future Movement. However, March 14 as a mentality, as an alliance with certain foreign forces and not others, might continue with new faces in this district and in other districts.
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at other places outside of West Beirut, you know, you go up to Tripoli, you have, you know, Karim Kabara running on Makati's list. Well, his dad has been running with Hariri for ages, right? And so, okay, is he really going to be not March 14th anymore? Similarly, you have other places where you still have like future candidates running, like Assemi Fatfat in Donie is running. You have up in Akkar, you have quite a few future MPs or former future MPs now, previously future MPs, who are actually running on different tickets, you know, like one with the LF and one without the LF. And the idea is, no, they're going to retain some sort of the same. They may not be called future, but most likely some of these candidates will win. And it's not like, okay, those 20 votes for Mustapha all of a sudden get shifted over to the March 8th column. No, that is not going to happen.
Yeah, and I have another point here, which is, yes, Future Movement is a core block in March 14 and will be significantly less powerful or present in some way or another in the next parliament. But also, FPM was the biggest block in what was called back then the March 8 presence in parliament, and it's expected to lose a lot as well. So in that sense, it's about who replaces, who grabs those seats on both ends. It doesn't, in many areas, it literally cannot be Hezbollah because Hezbollah doesn't exist in those areas, or it cannot be Hezbollah because Hezbollah doesn't have any loyal allies who will actually win there. So it's you can't think about it in this framework, really, because each of the districts where FPM is losing and Future Movement is losing will have a different battle. And according to the local battle there, we will eventually have this big picture of who might be considered March 14 and what kind of March 14, you know, the big major forces in March 14 or the people who are aligned but more independent. It will be a complex image.
Yeah, there are currents going in both directions right now.
Yeah,
I think you could say, and so it's very, very fraught to try to predict with any sort of precision. I think where things will land up, we'll know a whole lot more in a couple days' time, though. And the other thing a lot of people are talking about, besides the March 8th, March 14th split, is, you know, civil society again. This is a big, big question in the last election, right? Like, how many, you know, anti-Sulta opposition figures are actually going to make it into parliament this time. At the last time around, there was one, maybe if you consider Paula Yaoubian to be, you know, an outsider. This time, it seems as though they've got a bit more wind in their sails. I mean, the Thaura happened, which was, it was a huge political earthquake, which really meant for a lot of people, the traditional parties aren't up to the task. We need to go with someone new. So there does seem to be more energy and more, enthusiasm or more wind in the sails of these outsider parties.
Yeah, definitely. And as we said a couple of episodes ago, it's all about which areas there are, you know, there are different opportunities in different areas. And there has been serious repositioning by many people that are now, you know, saying they are opposition. And this matters a lot because these people used to be part of the establishment or the picture of the parliament that we were talking about earlier, but they have switched allegiances. So, for example, one MP who's kind of, you know, perceived as a guaranteed win is Namat Frem, big industrialist, ran with FPM last time in Kisarwan, this time running alone. And another guy who was elected by the FPM in the same district last time, Shamil Rukas, is on another list, not even with Namat Frem this time. You have Michel Daher, another big industrialist, who is also running again, not with the FPM this time, but allied with Kataib instead. And, you know, you have, for example, Michel Mawad, who ran last time with the FPM, but as a tactical alliance, who is also this time running with Kataib and Butros Harb's son. So many MPs that came on FPM's back to the last elections have switched sides. And many of these MPs are considering themselves opposition today. It doesn't mean that they will have, all of them will have the same politics in parliament. But it means that we will have not only the opposition in the sense of, okay, Yaoubian and other like relatively new faces not supported by big movements or parties, etc., but also what is being called now traditional opposition. Political families that exist in Lebanon and have been part of the establishment realigning or repositioning themselves now as opposition. So these families we've been talking about, all of which, you know, important families that have been in politics for a while. No one is new, neither Jmail nor Mawad nor anyone else is new to politics. So will we have, for example, after the election, as many people in the opposition are saying today, a block for real opposition MPs and then another block for traditional opposition like Jmail and Mawad, etc.? Or will it be something else? So we don't know for sure yet because, you know, these things are settled after each of these actors knows their weight and their presentation in parliament and what deals they can make and, you know, what size the block can be and all of these things. But it is a possibility that we have kind of two different blocks in parliament, both portraying themselves as opposition with differences in terms of what type of actor they are.
Right. But even if you strip it down to sort of like the new opposition, not the traditional, because the traditional opposition, they ran before as well, right?
Yeah.
So it's hard to put them in that same category. If we want to compare apples to apples, you know, new opposition, they won one seat. It seems like they have more support on their side now. Yeah. My perception, and I could be wrong, but...
No, definitely. There's more support. There's more momentum, but also there's more funding. There's more institutional support. There are many phenomena that we've been talking about in the last few episodes relating to businessmen coming together to support new parties, or you know, some alliances and coalitions among these movements and groups. There's a lot more interest in anti-establishment politics today than there was before, especially by the elites. So we're definitely seeing some kind of change in that direction. How many MPs will it be? We really don't know, because in most districts, we don't have one clear opposition list, even among the new opposition. In 13 out of 15 districts, we have one list that is formed of many groups and another list that is usually formed by مواطنون ومواطنات في دولة. So if the votes split in both directions, we will also have repercussions on how many electoral thresholds are passed by the by both sides.
Right, right. And it is also important to note, okay, so we talked about like lower bounds, but like upper bounds, you know, thinking back to the Thaura, kick them all out, let's have, you know, let's get 65 MPs. That's wild. That's way outside of what anybody is thinking of. If the new opposition, you know, does come in strongly, it's not going to be nearly that big. And that is the conventional wisdom, at least. The conventional wisdom is that the Sulta, the traditional, you know, parties, the traditional powers, they will retain, you know, quite dominant control over everything. But here we want to temper this again, and I just want to come back to this uncertainty point, because there are a number of things that just make this election not like the last one. And one of these things was the Thaura, obviously, which, you know, really repainted sort of the landscape on which the political actors have to play. How much this is going to factor in, I don't know. We're going to find out Sunday. Also, the economic collapse, that is something huge. We don't know exactly how that's going to play with the voters, how that's going to change their strategy, or, you know, whether they decide to vote or not. I mean, theoretically, from these two things, from this massive economic collapse and the Thaura, theoretically, there should be way more energy for change, right? There certainly was in 2019. But by this point, I feel like quite a few people feel disaffected. They feel like, oh, well, nothing changed. Nothing can change. Like there's a sort of feeling of depression that I get from certain people that, oh, it doesn't really matter. And so maybe they actually don't have as much wind in their sails as I thought. That this is a big question, a big point of uncertainty.
Yeah, and it's important to say here that the reason why it's difficult to measure this is because it can be manifested in very different ways. So it can be manifested in some people not voting, other people voting for new actors. And, you know, some people might say, because of how confusing and uncertain the situation is, we should go back to what we know and vote for who we trust and who we have a relationship with, which is our traditional zaim or political party. So it might go into different directions.
Right. And we do have something of an indication, because the expats voted last weekend. We don't know who they voted for, but we know what the turnout was. 63%. That's not bad, but not great either. I mean, there were it's roughly three times as many people who voted last time, just in raw numbers. But in terms of percent, it's just a bit of a bump up. I think last time it was 56% of expats voted. So we're seeing maybe a little bit more interest from the expats over last time. In terms of raw numbers, obviously it is significantly more. But on the whole, you know, percentage wise, there isn't this huge, like, oh yeah, 90% of expats were coming out because they want to see change, or, you know, they want to fight one of these battles. They really believe that these elections are going to change things.
Yeah. And one thing to note here is that people who vote from abroad have actively registered to vote, which usually means that the turnout you would expect to turn out to be higher, because people,
you would think,
you know, made the step to go and register, or to register online to vote for the elections. And this obviously doesn't apply to voters in Lebanon, because you're automatically registered to vote, unless obviously they made an error, which is also quite frequent. But, you know, that's a big difference in what the turnout really means.
And then there's another aspect to this, you know, energy question that I think is less explored in a lot of the media, and that is support for Hezbollah. I'm not entirely sure that they're going to have quite as much support this time as they did last time. You know, supporters, people who were voting for the Hezbollah Amal tickets in a lot of places. You know, last time they did amazingly well. It was down to, you know, a very good strategy that they had. They understood the electoral law, etc. This time around, the same anti-establishment sentiment, it's not just confined to the Thaura. Like, everyone in the country knows something is really wrong. And there are a lot of people who are supporters of Hezbollah, as I understand, who are extraordinarily disappointed in the fact that the party has moved in to really protect the establishment, most pointedly Nabi Berri.
Yeah.
And they see this as just like, come on, like we've got to get rid of this guy. We like Hezbollah, but why do we keep, you know, supporting and keeping Nabi Berri, who is, you know, who they see as very, very corrupt, in place? And so maybe there's demotivation even on that side as well. And that could affect areas, you know, in the south, even and across the country as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are two tensions that happened between Hezbollah's bases and its leadership maybe in the last 3-4 years. The first one is the disillusionment with the whole Berri-Hezbollah alliance. Generally speaking, from my friends who are supportive of Hezbollah as a military organization, as a resistance organization, even like politically in terms of regional politics, this is not translating today into votes. Like, I am telling you, so many of my friends who used to vote for Hezbollah are not voting this time. And some of them who are incredibly supportive of Nasrallah and Hezbollah itself as a resistance movement have a problem with its political elite, its own political elite. So they might not vote. They might cast as a punishment vote, like a blank vote, or they might even vote for the opposition. One of my friends, coming from a Hezbollah background, quite committed religiously, etc., yesterday was telling me that, was announcing actually publicly that he's going to vote for the opposition list, because he's saying these people are not anti-resistance. They agree that we need to resist, and they're not trying to, you know, eliminate our capacity to resist or anything. They're just trying to make the country work, because the people who we have been voting for have destroyed the country, especially because of the corrupt allies, the thieves that we are allying with, etc. This is the discourse.
And the decision to put Marwan Khairuddin on the ticket in South 3 has also caused a bit of a backlash. Lebanon's in the middle of a financial collapse. The banks aren't giving people their money, and the Amal Hezbollah list in that area has put the chair of one of the banks on their ticket.
Definitely, and it's backfiring already, because Hezbollah is having to justify and explain and make up all of these reasons for why voting for people that we know are, you know, evil people might be the correct thing to do, be it their longtime allies or be it someone like Marwan Khairuddin. Hezbollah is not trying to sell them to you. You know, they're not trying to say Marwan Khairuddin is a good guy or Nabih Berri is a good guy even. They're trying to say this is what we had to do to protect the resistance and our legacy and blah, 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 blah. And that's basically the whole discourse. And every time someone mentions, oh no, I shouldn't vote for you because of you, because you're doing this, they would say, yes, but we also defended the country. We lost thousands of martyrs, etc. Like, bringing back all of the other non-parliamentary, non-political institutions related achievements of Hezbollah and sacrifices of Hezbollah in order to justify this vote. And the last thing we saw, which is super interesting, is replacing the billboards on the highway, you know, that used to state Hezbollah's main slogan, are now replaced by Nasrallah pictures, because that's the photo that gets you the votes.
Right. Remember, this is the guy that, you know, has your back. Vote for him.
Exactly. And if your message is vote for Nasrallah, you know, it's much easier to kind of to push people for this last minute, go to the ballot box thing and do your duty thing. You know, it moves certain people to see his face involved in an electoral campaign like that.
Right. So this is another thing that introduces a little bit of uncertainty. I don't want to oversell this. It's not like, oh, all of a sudden the South is going to flip or like, no, that's not it. But there definitely does seem to be, I mean, the actual numbers will reflect this in some way. We just don't know how big that's going to be, it seems.
And here we're talking about number of votes, even more than number of MPs, more relevant to this, because even sometimes you might still win, but your performance, the turnout of your own voters might be much lower.
Okay, so we've got a number of things that introduce uncertainty into the election, you know, from the future movement to all the way to, you know, Hezbollah itself and their strategy.
And coming back to, you know, the interests involved in the elections and who's going to win what, etc. One thing that falls outside of this March 8, March 14 framework, but is very important, is something we've been also covering in the last few episodes, which is what we can refer to as the banking sector's representatives in the upcoming parliament. We've talked about how one banker, specifically, for example, Antoun Sahnawi, who is the chairman of SGBL, has reportedly funded many candidates during these election campaigns in order to secure seats in parliament. And these range from Beirut First with Nadim Jmail and Jean Talizian's list to Shouf Alay with reportedly support for Raji Saad from Walid Jumblat's list, and some rumors about others that we're not going to go through. But there's another PSP guy in Beqa, Wael Abu Fa'our, very major PSP figure, who's also reportedly being funded by Sahnawi, Michel Mawad in the north, etc. So this is one guy that we talked about because he represents a certain phenomenon, which is bankers electing people to represent their interests in parliament. However, we have also another phenomenon like Marwan Khairuddin that you mentioned, running himself, which comes with benefits such as parliamentary immunity, but also comes with a cost, which is the fact that, you know, this list has a banker on it and people will react to that. But what we kind of observed throughout this election is that the banking elite and the business elite in general in Lebanon is not putting all of its eggs in one basket. It understands that you need to support different people on different lists in different districts. And it's not all one, you know, coordinated effort. It's rather like a social dynamic where people from this elite are trying to be represented in what's coming, you know, in the new parliament, in the new Lebanon, and securing their interests there. So you will see them on different sides of the March 8, March 14, supposedly kind of framework. It doesn't matter so much to them, because when they reach parliament and talk about decisions that matter to their interests, March 14, March 8 will not be that relevant at all.
And this also, it pervades everything, whether we're talking about, you know, the Sulta or new parties coming, whether, you know, the old opposition, the new opposition, all of that. This is, I think, just like a natural feature of how elites function. You know, it's not like the elites are a single brain coordinating, oh, we've got to put different eggs and different bats. Like, no, there probably isn't this level of coordination at all. If anything, a lot of people within the elite actively hate each other. Some of them, yeah. You know, like there are rivalries, there's all this stuff, but the net result is that, you know, they maybe will filter onto different lists that span different divides, and then their interests, you know, some of them may be the same, some of them may be different. I mean, even within the Association of Banks in Lebanon, there are rumors about, you know, different factions that have different ideas about how to proceed right now. I mean, why wouldn't there be? So it isn't necessarily that, like, there's this banks party, quote unquote. In effect, though, you do have a lot of people representing sort of moneyed interests across a lot of different divides.
Yeah, and this proposes a certain challenge here to the idea that you should vote for whoever is the most popular or most powerful in your own district, as long as generally, politically, they're not like your big enemy. So we've heard people from supposedly, you know, Thawra opposition backgrounds, quote unquote, talking about voting for people like Makhzoumi, Na'amat Frem, etc., Michel Mawad, Kataib in Matin, most importantly. And they're going by this logic. If you can pull your votes into someone who already has supporters because they're a traditional party or whatever, and they can give to you, you know, beyond the first or second threshold and take away from the real enemies, share, which are, you know, the FPM and the March 8 people, etc., then we should support them. But then we ask here, is it really about, you know, the useful vote? Because useful for what exactly? Because all what matters really is what these MPs will be doing in parliament after they get elected. And from what we see today, the many of these people who are being called traditional opposition do represent the same governing interests that have been kind of overseeing the destruction of Lebanon's economy and financial system. So big question on how useful that is.
And beyond that, okay, so tactical voting, that's a normal thing. It happens in elections all over the world all the fucking time. But due to the complexities of Lebanon's electoral law, it's really fraught to make a tactical vote, I think, because you have to really be sure that things are going to break the way you think that they're going to break in order to really employ tactically vote smart. Like if you're an individual, if you're a party that controls a bunch of votes, yeah, you can actually play that game. But as individuals, it's quite hard to do. And essentially what you're doing is you're making a gamble. Just a few, you know, a shift of a few thousand votes one way or another might end up meaning that you're just giving your vote to the people that you really don't like.
Yeah, it's risky business, and it kind of goes against the logic that we've been seeing in this election and the past one, where people who are not necessarily opponents would not ally for the sake of kind of like splitting the vote in a positive way by, you know, electing different specific seats on each list depending on who has the highest chances. This electoral law makes it really all about individuals, in the sense if you have one list, you might have competition within that list. So one form of tactical voting that will happen this time is people voting for a specific candidate on a list to make sure that another candidate on the same list doesn't win. And I'm going to do that, to be very honest. I've shared that that perspective already on Twitter, that, you know, in the district where I vote, in Shufan Alay, my political vote would probably have gone elsewhere, but within the current reality, we see that there are many MPs competing on one seat that will definitely be won by the opposition according to estimations, which is the Maronite seat. So you have to decide like what each Maronite candidate will be doing in parliament and see which one will be closer to your interests. In Beirut Second, we also have a very hybrid opposition list. It almost doesn't make sense for me to vote for it, but if I would have voted for it, I would have chosen the best candidate who might win if they have real chances, in order to prevent a more right-wing candidate or a less, you know, less progressive candidate from winning. So it's really complex. It makes sense to think of tactical voting, but there are limits to where you can take it. You cannot take it to the extent of saying, no, I will vote for Sami Jmail, because Sami Jmail is not worried about his seats. You're just ensuring that Samir Saliba or Sam'an Boufadil or one of these people will be elected. And these people, if they don't represent you, there is absolutely no reason to vote for that list. You know, it doesn't make any sense going by that logic. If you are pro-opposition and there is a serious opposition list elsewhere, why would you do that? Why would you make that choice? If you make that choice, the opposition list might not get an MP, might not get through the threshold. The threshold will be lower. Who will benefit from that is debatable, because depending on how much is the share of each of the Sulta lists. But you are removing a main power from the equation if you decide to kind of go with the traditional opposition rather than the new opposition.
Right. And I think it's so important to keep that overall mindset in mind, because it's not just about who gets in or what forces win or what. It matters what are they going to do once they are seated in parliament. So once the vote happens on Sunday, then Lebanon is going to have several immediate, like nearly immediate post-election issues. And it's really important that that we keep that in mind going into the elections. And obviously, at least from my perspective, outsider, the real economic stuff, it seems so, so important just because of the scale of the collapse and the rising levels of poverty in the country. So what will actually happen with the IMF negotiations and the associated reforms that come with whatever support the IMF gives?
Yeah, definitely. The IMF situation will be a huge factor in what happens in Lebanon next, because this is what the system is depending on for funding. But also, there's a big, you know, some big major decisions to be made when it relates to how to approach the state's role in the economy and the economy overall and how to develop it in the future. Because on one hand, you have the IMF and the most experts, financial experts and economists who come from like neoliberal backgrounds talking in terms of we need to restore stability and balance to macroeconomic indicators, you know, like just make sure that on paper, the state is not bankrupt, that society can sustain itself. However, there are other people saying, wait, we're in a big trouble because economically, the structure of our economy is terrible. It's not productive. It's causing this huge trade balance. And therefore, we need active investment in productive economies, an active role of the state in developing an economy rather than just making sure it's within some certain indicators. You know what I mean? So this matters a lot because this implies spending, you know, decisions on what government will be spending on. Will it spend on infrastructure or will it spend way less on infrastructure to reduce spending? Will it spend on education and healthcare, things that are in transport, things that are in, you know, the most basic and important necessities of a functioning society, especially for poor people? Who cannot get private education, private healthcare, etc. These are, you know, the questions that matter a lot. What will be the general economic orientation and the actual literal policies that take you in one direction or another, in the macroeconomic sense, in the general economy sense?
Right, and you know, whether state assets get privatized to fill this, you know, gaping hole in the balance sheet. How losses are distributed throughout the system, you know, because a lot of people have their life savings still stuck in banks. They can't access it. How much money, you know, are they going to incur losses or not? And also, you know, like whether reforms actually happen, or is this just sort of like this slow moving process that we've seen over the last 3 years where no real reforms are made and things are just worse for everybody all around? There are different paths forward, and the next parliament is going to be the one dealing with a lot of this stuff. And that's not to mention basic stuff like electricity, basic goods, you know, the availability of basic goods, you know, the value of the lira. That's another big question. There's been a lot of reporting that suggests that BDL's intervention to support the value of the lira against the exchange value of the lira against the dollar could be coming to an end after the elections. That would be a huge deal, and likely we would see yet another collapse of the lira, that which would be unthinkable. And who decides on this? Right now it's Riyad Salemi, the governor of the central bank, but was it, I think, just a week ago or so, Mikati said that, oh, now that we've signed this, you know, initial deal with the IMF, the staff level agreement, I am no longer tethered to keeping Riyad Salemi. So his future is in question as well.
Yeah, because Riyad Salemi has not only been a controversial figure for Lebanon in terms of his role in the monetary policy and funding the state, etc., and his alleged corruption, you know, all of the cases that are happening against, lawsuits that are being filed against him in Lebanon and abroad. But also it's about the conflict that occurred when the government started negotiating with the IMF during Hassan Diab's government. And there was this a clear rift between what the BDL leadership and the banking sector wants and what the government wants and the IMF wants. So the government and the IMF seemed basically on the same page, while BDL and the banking sector were on another page. So BDL leadership changing might also be kind of part of an informal part of the deal that secures money for Lebanon. It's very important, but it's also a very political thing, because this is about the distribution of power in political institutions after the elections. You know, Riyad Salemi is a major figure that's not one way or another like political, because he's been basically organizing a huge process of capital distribution in Lebanon that a lot of people from very different backgrounds benefited from.
Right, he was seen as Hariri's man, but I mean, really, he knows everything, right? He is the Lebanon's banker. So he's got eyes on a lot of the, you know, financial sector in the country, which includes a lot more than just Hariri.
Yeah, and a new central bank governor might come with new policies on the monetary level, but also new politics. It depends on the distribution of power and whose names are supported by which foreign actors, etc. Like, it's always a complicated thing with any important post in Lebanon. We've been hearing the name of Kamil Bouslemen kind of promoted or floated around as a potential replacement for Riyad Salemi. Yes, he was the labor minister for the Lebanese forces, who was famous for his anti-Palestinian workers campaign, but also he's primarily someone who works with financial institutions in the financial sector, and he's kind of like a technocrat in that field, and his line of discourse and policy are very close to the IMF and financial elite in general, and we might see more coherence between international and local capital if this happens, you know, in the sense of having someone who is more reliable and more transparent in the BDL leadership might make things easier for the IMF to implement its policies and its program in Lebanon and to agree to more funding. One thing to note here is that the IMF doesn't give you all of the money in one go. And this is super important. You have to do certain reforms, cross certain milestones in order to get more money. So you need someone you can treat as a partner and deal with as a partner that you can trust, rather than unpredictable, mysterious, deep in the establishment kind of figure like Riyad Salemi.
Right. So we started out talking about sort of the economic consequences of the election, and now this is sort of like quasi-political, and then just moving on into the overtly political side of things. I mean, obviously, we will have a new parliament, and that, you know, first thing up means who's going to be running that new parliament, not just the speaker, but deputy speaker and, you know, the seven people who are sort of like the secretariat of the parliament. Also, who's going to be the next prime minister? The conventional wisdom is that Najim Meati would be nominated again for what would be his fourth government, and that the next cabinet that he would try to form would probably look somewhat similar to the one that Lebanon has today, with maybe some changes, and maybe some of those changes depend on exactly what happens with these elections. But also they'll be wanting to form a cabinet quite quickly, because this cabinet probably has a limited shelf life. At least if Lebanon follows the constitution, it will have a limited shelf life, because whenever you have a new president, then the cabinet is automatically considered resigned. Michel Aoun's term as president ends on Halloween, October 31st of this year. And so actually, we were talking in an earlier episode about how Mekati came into this cabinet and really didn't have any time to do anything. The main thing was elections. There isn't going to be enough time to like do a full, you know, IMF program or anything like that, get started on it. But the main thing was elections. Now there's only going to be, you know, another handful of months before the next constitutional deadline. The clock is ticking immediately. So Mekati is going to want to form a government as quickly as possible, if that's possible, to get that done so there is a cabinet in place by the end of the president's term. Obviously, a lot of energy in the political class is going to turn not only to cabinet formation, though, but is going to be looking ahead to who is going to be the next president. I'm not sure exactly how much energy is going to be expended on these economic issues versus how much, you know, political energy and capital is going to be focused on securing Baabda Palace for the next 6 years. And of course, there are other potential scenarios that are not fun to think about. You know, what happens if they aren't able to form a cabinet? What happens if they can't agree on a president? Because look at the history of the past few years and how that's gone. You know, there is a non-zero chance of a constitutional crisis later this year. So these are issues that the political class, that the incoming class of MPs is going to need to solve immediately, unless they want another constitutional crisis.
And the constitutional crisis in a situation like this would be different from what we've seen before because of how deep the economic and financial and social crisis is. It's not fun to look forward to that, but at the same time, it's realistic to expect it because what we've seen so far from the ruling class in Lebanon is way less interest in managing the country and getting it out of the crisis and way more interest in keeping things as they are as much as possible. And the, in terms of the political dynamics, in terms of dominance and power and everything, protecting banks' interests, protecting other private interests. So all of these things will be at stake after the elections and nothing will change fundamentally because of a vote. It doesn't happen this way. It's about power, taking power, implementing decisions. So it's really about who has the power, which interests they represent, and what connections and support they can get for pushing in one direction or another. It's really, we have no idea how it's going to happen now because we cannot and we should not be predicting.
But we will know more when we come back to you next week.
With the results of the election.
Yeah, this is a limited series. Next week is going to be our last week. And we're going to come back with all the results, assuming that we get them in a timely fashion. And whatever larger takeaways we have from this. And hopefully that will not center on constitutional crises, for God's sakes.
All right, then. That's it for this week. Next week, we're not sure which day we will come back because it depends on which day the results are out officially and we can make sense of things and prepare and edit and do all of these things. But it should be before Friday or Thursday, like something during the week.
I think Friday at the latest.
Yeah, at the latest, just so that we're not rushing it into, you know, just telling you the results, which you can get anywhere. We'll try to step back and give you some interesting analysis. So, until then, I'm Nizar Hassan.
I'm Benjamin Red.
And this has been the Lebanese Politics Podcast.
The Lebanese Politics Podcast is brought to you by me, Benjamin Red, Nizar Hassan, who also produces it, and the music was by Omar Al-Fil.